Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Kentucky Auditor Mike Harmon has released the first volume of the statewide single audit of Kentucky, and he says the findings identify within the Office of Unemployment Insurance and Unemployment Insurance Fund should be deeply concerning to taxpayers and those who have filed for unemployment insurance benefits. He's on the line with us now. Mike Harmon, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Very good. And if you would first give our listeners a brief overview of your findings about the state's unemployment insurance system.
Sure. Well, this is a release of what we call our SWAG, the Statewide Single Audit of Kentucky. Every year we do three major audits of Kentucky. One of them we just got through releasing back in December, which is our audit of the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. And then the SWAC Volume 1, which is what we just released, usually occurs about this time, and then SWAC Volume 2 will come a little bit later. In this particular year, as we were looking over the different agencies, the Office of Unemployment had about half of the findings. There were a total of 25 findings. The Office of Unemployment is about half of them. And obviously, this was a challenging time. The pandemic was coming on. Businesses were being shut down. And then certainly unemployment was, we had people towards the end of the March, there was well over 40-some thousand individuals 1 week, and the following week, well over 100,000. So it was a challenging time. But during this time, sadly, if we were working for the unemployment, it appears that there was really a systemic failure in leadership when it comes to address. Because obviously, they were well-intended, but leadership made a decision to do what they called auto pay, probably a well-intentioned attempt to try to get checks out to people who were unemployed as quickly as possible. But what happened was when they did that, you took off certain controls, and part of those controls made it more subject to fraud. So you got a situation where you've got an aging system, you've got fewer people, but then you've also got situation where you're creating more problems than you're solving. Some of the things that we found, beyond that, we found sadly when everybody was trying to get through and couldn't get through to try to get their unemployment, we found that there was over 400,000 emails that were just archived. They were not even opened. Some of the other things that we found and probably directly connected to the auto pay, there were state workers that still held a full-time position, but had lost income due to a part-time job. And of course, everybody was encouraging everybody to apply for unemployment if they lost any income at all. So individuals applied, and we did a sampling. We did a survey or test of about 37 of those. We found 16 of those 37 received unemployment benefits that really were not eligible. And part of the reason, that we believe that that occurred for about a 2 week period for traditional unemployment and about an 8 week period for the new pandemic unemployment. When that auto pay was put on, certain questions were not asked, controls were taken off. And one of the questions they would generally ask is, if you're a full-time employee, but they would ask what sort of income that you have currently. And so they would look at that, and there would be a percentage of that, and then that would subtract from what you would be eligible for unemployment. And typically, that would yield a zero. But that question was not asked during that time frame. And we found that there was approximately, of those that we tested, there was about $116,000 in payments paid out that really were not supposed to. Now, and remember, that's a sampling, so that number could actually be larger.
On the emails, let me ask you this. Is it, I think we have a number of 400,000
total unanswered.
Correct.
Received in various state agency inboxes. And does that number represent 400,000 emails from 400,000 people or many emails sent to multiple inboxes by far fewer people?
These were emails that were sent to the unemployment assistance line. So basically people where they were trying to either get information to them or had questions about their unemployment that were just moved over, that were never opened, were archived. You know, it looks like based on what our auditors found, there was a period where they were trying to sort and organize them. And I guess they just got so overwhelmed, they just kind of gave up and, you know, moved them over without even opening them. But I would think at a minimum, you could get individuals to, you know, prioritize first in, first out and review it. Because, you know, during that same time frame, there were some tips that came over via email regarding security breaches, you know, security breaches of information, which is also in a report. So really, if you're not reviewing the information, you don't know whether or not someone was sending another email about an additional breach or whether they were trying to figure out whether, you know, about their unemployment. Because, you know, I had, like I said earlier, I had multiple people reach out to me so frustrated because they were trying to call and couldn't get through and email and couldn't get through. And even some working with their state rep and state senator still couldn't get through. So it was a very frustrating time. And I know, you know, at the time that we released our report or when we were actually reviewing, you know, there were still 80,000 that had not been settled on their claims. And I know a news report just recently, you know, said it was, you know, a little over 100 now. So there are still individuals trying to get through the noise. So it's, you know, I'm sure it's very frustrating for individuals that they just can't get through and you know, emails, that many emails were ignored.
Could it be argued that problems that had been building for decades led to this backlog, including cutting staff?
Yeah, you know, I think there you could, to a portion of the arguments, you could say that, you know, we had dated, you know, computer systems, you know, staff had been cut. And if my understanding, there had been some cut not only during the previous administration, but the administration previous to that. But even if you had the best system, even if you had the number of people you felt like you should have, if you turn the controls off, if you turn off those key questions, you're going to create more problems. So my guess is if they had not turned those controls off, they still would have had challenges, but they perhaps would not have created those additional problems, including an increased probability of fraud. I'm sure you still have some anyway, but an increased probability of fraud by turning those controls off. So now you're trying to address people's concerns while also trying to figure out, you know, have you paid money out to people that are not supposed to receive it? And, you know, you had some situations where some of the individuals that were paid money that were not supposed to receive it are now, you know, in the process of having to pay that back. So, and then you also had, like we said earlier, you had people that were receiving unemployment that really weren't supposed to receive it. And you had people that were supposed to receive unemployment that's not getting it. So it's just very frustrating for everybody involved, I would imagine.
We're talking with Kentucky State Auditor Mike Harmon. Mike, you were a legislator in 2009, 2010, when Kentucky was offered $90 million from the federal government to make several improvements to our unemployment insurance system, and that included upgrading those woefully outdated computers. But that offer was allowed to lapse, and it wasn't like we didn't realize that there were issues with our unemployment insurance system because a task force was, in fact, looking into the problems with the system at that time, and that task force ended up focusing its recommendations on the solvency of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And I'm wondering why, when we had the chance to make important changes to our program and get federal money to do it, why did we fail to take advantage of that?
Back in that time frame, I don't recall why we didn't go ahead and try to utilize that. Typically, in that, of course, I was in the minority. I was always in the minority in the House until I left, you know, to become auditor. But, you know, generally speaking, if there were funds available, especially the upgrade, we usually tried to do it. Now, I don't recall at the time, perhaps there were, you know, some severe strings attached that they just didn't want to pursue. You know, certainly, I think if it was during that time frame, which I believe you're correct, that would have been during the time frame of the previous Governor Beshear, Steve Beshear. And at that time, of course, the House was controlled by the Democrats and the Senate was still controlled by the Republicans. But I can't recall specifically, but my guess is probably there were some strings attached that one or some of those groups did not want to have tied to it.
One final question for you. We have known for decades that the system is old and our processes are inflexible. Under governors from both parties and with legislatures controlled by both parties, what could have been done in the past to prevent what has happened now that we've been faced with this major public health emergency?
Well, and the hard thing is whenever you look at a situation like this, you can look at it solely as this individual topic. But what a lot of people, you know, don't realize is every year you have to deal with multiple issues. And budget issues are always so difficult because there's always so many wonderful things that you would like to do. But at the same time, you have a limited budget to work with. It's okay to like reduce staff a little bit, but, you know, people deal more with like a regional aspect. They like something that's close to them so that individuals don't have to drive so far or if they can't get through on the telephone. But certainly making sure that we have sufficient staffing, making sure that we update our computers. But anything that we do takes money. And in the time frame you were talking about, 2008 and 2009, sadly, you know, we were dealing with some significant budget struggles, mm-hmm. not only as a state, but as a nation during that time frame. And then we were still dealing with our pension. I mean, we've been dealing with pension crisis for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those things. You have to kind of prioritize, you know, what gets the most priority while at the same time still making sure something is covered. But the ability to predict a situation like this that occurs once in 100 years, you know, it's tough. It's tough.
Kentucky Auditor Mike Harmon, we thank you so much for your time.
Well, we appreciate you having me. And certainly if you have any other questions, just let me know.
We'll do that. The auditor's report came up during Governor Beshear's briefing on the day of its release. His response.
Now, these are challenging times. And when you cut and cut and cut a safety net like previous administration or previous General Assemblies did, you leave us 90-something people short. The budget almost cut in half. All the local offices closed, and an IT system that should have been replaced 10 years ago. And then all of a sudden you have the most filings ever on top of that. You're set for the perfect storm. But to go through a little more point by point, we have Amy here. But again, you see this is happening in every state across America, but that's not an acceptable excuse. People have needed our help. We've been able to help the vast majority of them. But anybody out there who still needs help that we haven't gotten to, and that's our failure.
More on the matter of Kentucky's ailing unemployment insurance system coming soon on Eastern Standard. Opening schools is not a simple answer. That's the title of an op-ed in the Lexington Herald Leader, co-authored by Melinda Moore, an associate professor in the Department of Psychology here at EKU, and Julie Serrell, a licensed psychologist and professor in the College of Social Work at the University of Kentucky. And Dr. Moore joins us now to talk about some pros and cons of reopening schools and how the pandemic that has made us more comfortable with gathering virtually has driven a boost in teletherapy. Melinda Moore, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
So there have been these recent reports by such outlets as the New York Times and NPR focusing on the impact of pandemic school closings in Las Vegas. And they note that an early warning system that monitors students' mental health episodes has sent more than 3,100 alerts to district officials raising alarms about suicidal thoughts, possible self-harm, or cries for help. By December, 18 Clark County, Nevada students had taken their own lives. You study and monitor suicide both across the country and here in Kentucky. What's your reaction to what's being highlighted and reported about Nevada?
Well, Nevada has historically had very high suicide rates. Typically, they've been at the highest levels across the country. And youth suicide has been on the rise for more than 10 years. So youth suicide has been a problem that predates the pandemic. And as I said, you know, Nevada has historically had higher suicide rates. So it would make a lot of sense to me that, you know, 18 is an unacceptable number, but it is consistent with what they've experienced previously.
As clinicians who study suicide and work closely with children and adolescents in various settings, what can you tell us about the volume of distressed, anxious, sometimes suicidal children and adolescents who've come across your threshold?
Yeah, so I'm a supervisor in the trauma and suicide prevention clinic that's within the EKU Psychology Clinic. And we are, even though the university is primarily conducting most of its business virtually and our telehealth clinic is up and running, although we're not seeing face-to-face clients in our clinic, we are seeing an influx. I mean, this is more anecdotal, of definitely very anxious, depressed, worried, and sometimes suicidal children and adolescents. And because we do suicide-focused treatment in our clinic, we are serving quite a few young people who are suicidal in our clinic as well.
There's so much going on right now around reopening or not reopening schools. And I wonder what facts should we be considering in this debate over whether to reopen schools?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it makes sense that people, after nearly a year of, you know, being socially distanced and, you know, doing distance learning, people are anxious to get back to school. But the problem is we are in the midst of really, you know, in our lifetime, an unprecedented pandemic. These are dire circumstances where the risk of infection is still so great. So, for instance, in Nevada, there's been a real push to reopen the schools. The superintendent of Clark County has been under great pressure to reopen the schools, but they still are reporting high COVID-19 numbers. And so, I mean, I think we have to weigh the risk of infection, not just the risk of infection to the child or the adolescent, but then what is that child or adolescent bringing home to their parents or grandparents, and the risk of death among, you know, not just the child, but again, the parent or grandparents, because, you know, this pandemic doesn't seem to be affecting children, although we don't really know the long-term effects of it. And certainly, you know, we're seeing with the multi-infection, you know, system that's, you know, the problems that are being created within children, the MIS-C that's being created within children, we don't know what the long-term health consequences are. So I think the risk of all of that, weighing that against the benefits of reengaging in face-to-face learning, I think has to really be carefully weighed. And unless we have protocols and unless there's some, you know, mass vaccination, I'm not certain the risk is really worth the benefit given the circumstances.
In the op-ed that you've written, you make note that many parents are concerned that their children are now falling behind, and you say that this kind of thinking needs to stop. Why?
Well, I mean, I think they are very concerned, and you know, with good reason, about, you know, the grade level skills that their children are getting. But again, you know, this is an unprecedented time. We're not talking just about achieving grade level skills. We're talking about saving lives. And I think that this idea that we must send children back to school so that they can try to achieve these grade level skills, I think it's a little short-sighted. I think we really need to consider the overall picture and the risk and the fact that this is an unprecedented experience that we're all going through. And like I said, the risk of infecting parents and grandparents will impact children for the rest of their lives if, let's say, the parent or the grandparent dies as a result of that infection, or they themselves will experience long-term health effects But I think we have to really prioritize what's important here, you know, safety over the short-term, you know, deficiencies of not being face-to-face.
Well, I think at this point, virtual meetings via Zoom or Skype or FaceTime or Google are no longer novel. So I'd like to turn to teletherapy and wonder how this technology has been working out as a way to get effective help to people who are being careful about following social distancing protocols in these pandemic conditions that we're living under. How's that working?
Yeah, you know, this has been the advent of teletherapy has been an incredible boon for psychological services. We immediately in our psychology clinic, the EKU Psychology Clinic, converted all of our psychological services, assessment services to teletherapy. And as I said, you know, we saw over 3,900 individual visits last year. In the past year, since last March, we've had served a lot of people, like I said, 3,900 client visits. And so we've been able to continue to serve people, even people who were, you know, really at risk, really high risk, but also doing sort of traditional, you know, more psychological services through this particular medium. And I think this surprised all of us. A lot of people were really concerned that it wouldn't work, that it wouldn't be private, that the technology, you know, wouldn't be up to snuff. But what we found is very quickly, the technology's there with some following protocols and following rules and guidelines. You know, we know that it's confidential. And so really we are finding in our psychology clinic that we're able to provide these services rather well, and with all of the safeguards around confidentiality. And the added benefit to this is that, you know, the individual, whether it's a child or adolescent or an adult, they don't have to leave their house. They can do this from the privacy of their own home. So not coming to our clinic has actually been an incredible benefit. People oftentimes feel shy coming to, you know, a public place for something that they think is, you know, so sensitive. But being able to do it within the confines of their own home, the privacy of their own home, has really been a huge benefit.
Do you think that because we've become so much more accustomed to virtual meetings via Zoom and so forth, has that made a difference in, well, let me put it this way. It seemed, before the pandemic, it seemed a little impersonal for this kind of intimate discussion. But has that changed now?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think we're finding that some people prefer face-to-face psychological treatment rather than telehealth. Some people prefer telehealth. I think what occurs, though, we are finding, particularly with individual psychological treatment, that we are able to affect the kind of change that we need to affect with the people that we're serving. And so we're finding that it's just as effective, particularly with individual psychotherapy. And, you know, we're also finding that there are some people who actually prefer it. I think this has changed the landscape of psychotherapy moving forward. I don't think we'll ever go back and just only have face-to-face treatment.
You've also raised concerns about student athletes. What worries you there?
Yeah, you know, I think student athletes, I mean, they're incredibly disciplined people that are committed to excellence. And I think sometimes, you know, that very kind of rigid thinking, very perfectionistic thinking can get them in trouble. And one of the things that we've seen, I know in our clinic, are seems like more student athletes who are, you know, really struggling with anxiety and suicidal ideation and other mental health concerns. And of course, we've seen, you know, people like Michael Phelps and other, you know, athletes talk about their own struggles and own bouts with depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation, sometimes suicidal behavior. And, you know, we've even seen some episodes, you know, anecdotally here and there of student athletes, you know, who really struggled with this locally. So I think, you know, I would just encourage student athletes to see help seeking as really a strength, and they don't have to solve their problems themselves, and really alert coaches to the fact that, you know, we've got resources at EKU. We've got suicide focused treatment resources, and we certainly are available very easily through the technology that we use. And so I would encourage them to reach out and get some help from us if they need it.
Well, here we are. We're nearly an entire year into this pandemic, and as dearly as I would love to be able to say that there is a bright light now shining at the end of the tunnel, it's not. We're not there yet. And that raises a couple of questions in my mind. First, are we changing?
That's a really good question, and I'm not certain I'm wholly qualified to answer that question. I will tell you, as a researcher who researches what happens in the aftermath of trauma, I study something called post-traumatic growth. I think it's quite possible that if we allow it, we can allow some of the changes that have been created within us to also create growth. What I'm seeing anecdotally among my colleagues, among my students, among people I work with clinically, is that they are really understanding that there are priorities in their lives, and they really, you know, they have vowed to me that after this is over, they're going to be spending a lot more time with their families, they're going to be spending more time traveling, and I think savoring it, savoring those relationships, savoring those experiences. And also, I've seen a lot of people say, you know, I'm not really happy with my job. I think I want to change my job. So I think, you know, deciding where you want to spend your time, who you want to spend it with, and what you want to be doing, I think we're going to see it's a potential for great growth in the aftermath of this.
It's interesting. I've especially been hearing that last one from a number of people. But I'm also wondering, part two of that question would be, what are some effective coping mechanisms that we might try?
Well, I mean, I'm always a big lover of, you know, mindfulness and doing things where we, you know, calm ourselves. So engaging in, you know, Zoom meditation groups. We've got those at EKU through the Counseling Center, and then we also have Zoom groups that are available through the EKU Psychology Clinic. But, you know, there are lots of things in the community and also internationally. That's the great thing about this, you know, advent of Zoom and teleservices. You know, we don't have to go to church at our local, you know, temple or cathedral or church. You know, we can go to mass, or we can attend temple anywhere in the world that has some sort of Zoom service. So one of the things that I've been really struck by is the fact that, you know, I'm not just restricted to my geographic area, whether it's for, you know, involving myself in a reading group or a meditation group or going to some sort of practice of faith. And so I think there's lots of things out there that we can try. And, you know, things like, I'm a big fan of the UCLA Mindfulness Center. They have wonderful groups that meet, and also wonderful downloadable podcasts. So, I mean, I think it's just, there are many wonderful ways of coping, and I think these are just a couple.
Melinda Moore, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychology at Eastern Kentucky University. Melinda, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, part two of Corinne Boyer's series about what's happening as an opioid epidemic overlaps with a coronavirus pandemic, App Harvest, NASDAQ, and the first harvest of tomatoes, and a book for your nightstand filled with vivid characters. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, February 22nd through 26th is Arts Week in Kentucky. This free online event will focus on what's going on in the arts in the Commonwealth and put a spotlight on virtual performances and demonstrations by Kentucky performing and visual artists. For more information and to register for this free virtual event, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. And in Pikeville, you can check out the Crossroads exhibit beginning February 20th at the Appalachian Center for the Arts. The exhibit runs through April 3rd and is part of the Smithsonian Institution Traveling Exhibition Service. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
There are about 25,000 people in Kentucky prisons. The opioid epidemic has been blamed for the significant increases in incarcerations in recent years. And then along came COVID-19. The combination of isolation, stress, and coronavirus restrictions on treatment has been deadly, pushing overdose deaths to a record level. In the second of a series of reports, Corinne Boyer asked experts from the Ohio Valley and in the new Biden administration how they're treating addiction during a pandemic.
Since 2012, Second Chance Center for Addiction Treatment has treated people with substance and opioid use disorders in Lexington. As news of the COVID-19 pandemic unfolded, CEO Dr. Tuan Tran knew what the implications might mean for his patients.
We're going to probably see a surge in the number of cases of patients experiencing suicidal ideation, increase patients with addiction, and for those who have been stable in treatment, the increased isolation will result in multiple relapses.
Tran says the clinic couldn't monitor some patients for months, and the lack of face-to-face interaction resulted in additional illicit drug use. During the pandemic, the U.S. has suffered the largest number of overdose deaths in a 12-month period. And overdose deaths in parts of the Ohio Valley rose even faster than the national average. But the pandemic has also catalyzed additional responses to the epidemic. One Second Chance client agrees that the pandemic will lead to an increase of people with addiction. He asks that we not use his name because of the stigma associated with addiction.
Anytime you have people with addiction and they're being forced to stay at home, I think it's going to create a bigger problem.
He says he comes from a stable background, has a job and a family, but the isolation is, quote, extremely tough. He doesn't think the disease is widely understood. He says the public
doesn't have a very broad knowledge of what people with addiction go through, what the disease is. People with addiction are kind of left behind.
Second Chance saw how gaps in treatment were leaving clients behind. The staff extended Wi-Fi to the parking lot so people could participate in group therapy sessions from their cars. Tran says patients without phones or internet used an isolated space in the clinic to safely attend telemedicine visits.
We take it for granted everyone has a cell phone, everyone has a laptop or a computer, but that's not necessarily the case.
West Virginia is the state with the nation's highest overdose death rate. Christina Mullins, a commissioner for the state's Department of Health, says relapses are common because of the chronic nature of the disease. When the federal government awarded the state nearly $44 million last year to address the crisis, she says the first goal was a massive distribution of the overdose reversal drug naloxone.
And to be completely honest, our goal was to stop deaths so that we could get people into treatment or back into treatment.
Transportation is a barrier for some rural clients, so West Virginia's Department of Health and the State Public Transit Association worked together to offer free rides.
And since the pandemic started, we've run over 7,700 of those deviated routes, getting people back and forth to where they need to be. It has been one of the biggest challenges in my public health career.
At the federal level, health officials are just beginning their duties in the Biden administration and acknowledge that more people with substance use disorder need access to treatment. Regina LaBelle is Biden's acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy.
We have to develop a treatment infrastructure around this country that makes sure that we can get people the treatment they need, the services they need, when they need it.
LaBelle says the pandemic has allowed for some policy revisions that improved access to treatment, such as telehealth.
The ability to do telehealth has been a game changer for their ability to connect with their patients. And it's really helped to retain people in treatment during this very uncertain time.
LaBelle says her office will look at what temporary policy changes should be made permanent to remove barriers from treatment. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Corinne Boyer.
App Harvest has been back in the news lately, all happening in 1 week. The first tomato harvest at that greenhouse near Moorhead that's big enough to hold 45 football fields. And on February 1st, this vision of UK grad Jonathan Webb began trading publicly on NASDAQ. He joins us now. Greetings, Jonathan.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. And Jonathan, you recently had quite a week. You took the company public around the same time that you harvested your first round of tomatoes grown in that gigantic greenhouse near Moorhead. And we'll get to that in a moment, but first, going public, what brought you to that decision?
Well, Tom, we've said since day one, we want to bring transparency to food and agriculture, and there's no better way to do that than to have the institutional rigor of being a public company. It allows us to raise the bar on our standards internally. And we're very fortunate that we had a group of investors that wanted to help guide us to that public market. So it's been pretty remarkable for most of the people involved with the effort. But it's not the end. It's really just the beginning. So you know, right now, it's just setting us up for decades of work to come in the next couple of years.
And you just mentioned that it will force you to strengthen your standards internally. What do you mean by that?
Well, just, Tom, going from a startup and to the public markets, now we just have the scrutiny of you know, living up to the public markets. I think there's less than 20 publicly traded companies in Kentucky. You know, Papa John's, Tempur Sealy, Humana, Valvoline, and we're one of those few public companies. So it's going from the private market of private market fundraising to the public markets, and it's good and it's humbling for a lot of our team to know that you know, what we're doing day in and day out is making ripples not only in this region, you know, but in major markets around the world. So we have a lot of work to do in the years ahead, but you know, we're very fortunate to have this opportunity and to be a NASDAQ-listed company.
AppHarvest is certified as a B Corp, and that's defined as meeting the highest standards of verified social and environmental performance, public transparency, as you mentioned, and legal accountability to balance profit and purpose. Does going public present any conflicts between that mission and the expectations of investors?
Tom, this is what I loved. We're a registered benefit corporation, but we also have the certification from B Labs as a B Corp. And those are two different, one's a certification and then one's how you're actually registered as a company.
Mm-hmm.
We're one of the very few public benefit corporations that are publicly traded on a major exchange, less than a handful. You know, it made, and through the process of meeting with bankers, it was an interesting conversation with people on Wall Street of, well, wait a second, it says in your bylaws you don't just have fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders, you have responsibility to a larger group of stakeholders, both in the community, the environment, and our workforce and partners broadly involved with the effort. And it was an interesting conversation where we were able to make the case that in order to be a good, strong company in 10 or 20 years from now, you know, we need to be making investments that aren't going to just hit our bottom line and aren't just going to affect quarterly earnings. And we were very fortunate. We had 22 meetings with investors, and we had 17 investors commit to come in and invest in the company. You know, very few people passed on the opportunity. And I hope coming out of COVID, you know, there's an opportunity for large investors and those investors on Wall Street to either be a part of the solution and invest in companies that have purpose at their core, or, you know, we see companies that you know, have caused so many problems in so many different ways. So we stood firm on keeping our public benefit corporation status. It was tricky at times, kind of through the legal framework, but I hope that as we go forward, you know, we'll see more and more companies that are public benefit corporations, and they don't just have fiduciary responsibility to investors and shareholders, but we also have responsibilities to the community and environment at large.
Well, I mentioned earlier that you've done your first harvest. I take it that was from the greenhouse near Moorhead and tomatoes, right?
That's right. We're growing tomatoes. So a lot of hard work goes into this, but a pretty simple product in the end. And right now we're shipping our first harvest.
Well, and that brings up another subject that I wanted to get into with you, and that's the small farm community in Kentucky and how they view AppHarvest. A bit through a skeptical lens, it sounds as though as they learn more about AppHarvest, that's beginning to dissipate. But there's a concern that the competition, as they perceive it, would be just too much for them to stay in business. But does AppHarvest compete with the small farmer?
We absolutely want to partner with local farmers. And we've tried to make it abundantly clear that you know, no one here is our competition. Unfortunately, Tom, you know, most of the fruit and vegetable production in the U.S. right now, a vast majority of it comes from Mexico. And when you look at local production, it is just a very, very small portion of what the overall market is. 4 billion pounds of tomatoes were imported from Mexico into the U.S. last year, and those numbers keep going up. So we need to figure out how to work together with local farmers and push them onto store shelves with us. I would say the complete opposite, that us being on the store shelves doesn't hurt the local farmer. We're working to try to hopefully push imports off the store shelves, which then creates a larger opportunity for local farmers to get on the store shelves with us. We just had black soil out at our farm last week, which represents a large constituent of African-American farmers in Kentucky. And we did a CSA with black soil to give our 300 employees baskets of fruits and vegetables from local farmers. So we want to partner with the local farmer. We want them to know that we stand with you. But yeah, it's a rough time in agriculture. There's no doubt about it. I mean, there's so many different reasons why small family farms are struggling. But at the end of the day, it's pretty simple. We need to make sure, you know, the local farmers have space on those major store shelves. And we're selling at the top 25 grocers. And we got to make sure the local farmer gets on store shelves too. The other thing I would say, Tom, is, you know, we're doing our first harvest intentionally in the middle of winter. So think about this. Our first harvest and trucks were going out as it was snowing on the hillsides in Appalachia. And if a local farmer can't grow in the dead of winter in the snow, we're operating at peak capacity. So we'll be ramping down over the summer, and we're doing that to clean out our facility in the middle of when local farmers will be going online. But again, at the end of the day, it's not an us versus them at all. It's we've got to work together. And the competition is really pretty clear and singular. It's Mexico and potentially California. But, you know, local farmers here, we all have to work, figure out how to be helpful and get the local farmer back on the store shelf.
And you have a couple more facilities going up in Madison County. What will be grown in those?
Near Berea, we'll be building a 15-acre leafy green facility that will do a whole host of different variety of leafy greens year-round. And then another facility near Eastern Kentucky University, and that's a 60-acre facility. We have not publicly talked about what we're growing in there next. But so a part of going public, we've set a growth trajectory to build 12 facilities by 2025, and we'll be growing in all those facilities vine crops, leafy greens, and berries. So we'll have a whole host of different crops in our various facilities. But we look forward to getting those next few online here pretty soon.
Okay, Jonathan, one more question. This is a very serious one because it comes from somebody who kind of wraps his summer around the BLT. What does an app harvest tomato taste like?
I eat mainly plants, a lot of fruits and vegetables, and I'm a consumer of our product, and I was in tears when I ate the first app harvest tomato because you look at the, and it's plump, it's juicy, it's red, it's flavorful. It's the same thing if your grandmother's growing a tomato in the backyard. It's the way it should taste. And if you look at, you know, our competition that's importing from Mexico, those seed varieties are genetically modified for transportation. They have no flavor. They have no nutrient density. You know, they're hard, sometimes waxy. So it's a good product. It's the way a fruit and vegetable should taste. So my number one recommendation is to always go to, you know, your grandmother or your mom or dad's backyard and get your fruit and vegetables from your backyard. But in the event that you're not doing that, we're working hard to make sure you can have a good, tasty fruit and vegetable at the grocery store year-round.
Jonathan Webb, founder and CEO of App Harvest. Jonathan, always fun to hear what you're up to now, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks, Tom. Come visit soon.
Another Kentuckian who has been enjoying positive attention for her work is Tom Eblen's guest for this latest installment in his series of interviews with Kentucky writers.
When Kentuckian Lisa Cross Smith published her first novel, Whiskey and Ribbon, 2 years ago, one reviewer described her as a consummate storyteller. That debut novel made Oprah Magazine's list of best books of the summer. Cross Smith followed that book in 2020 with a second short story collection, So We Can Glow, that NPR named as one of the year's most notable books. Now she has a second novel out, This Close to OK. Like her first novel, this one is set in Louisville, where she lives with her husband, Lauren, and their two children. Smith's books are page-turners about everyday people, their strengths, their weaknesses, their relationships, and how they lean on each other to navigate the storms of life. Her characters are realistic and memorable, and the scenes she puts them in are so vivid you feel like you're there. Lisa Cross Smith is a prolific young Kentucky writer you will be hearing a lot more about in the future, and I'm pleased to have her with us today on Eastern Standard to talk about her work. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for your kind words.
Oh, well, it's a really terrific novel. I really enjoyed it. Well, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, I always put that I'm a homemaker on there first. I did that at the beginning, especially when I was first just submitting and trying to get my first book out. But I still say that first because, you know, that's the job I'm doing 24 hours a day. I have teenagers here in their home now, of course, instead of being in actual school because we're still doing online. But yeah, a homemaker and a writer and a member of the Jane Austen Society of North America. That's how I describe myself.
Okay. Well, without giving away any big secrets, tell us some about this book, This Close to OK.
Yeah, so at the very beginning of this book, my character Tally Clark is on her way home from the gym, on her way home from work, and she sees a man standing on the edge of a bridge, perched as if he's going to jump. And so she jumps out of the car and stops him, convinces him not to take his life and just to spend some time with her just so she can distract him, really. So they end up going for a cup of coffee, and they spend the entire Halloween weekend together. She invites him back to her house. And through the course of the events of the book, they are both learning the secrets about each other, and also that the man on the bridge is not the only one who needs healing. Tally has a lot of work to do, too. The big thing that she's holding back is that she is a therapist for her profession. She doesn't tell him that in case he has an aversion to talk therapy, so she does keep that big secret from him.
Well, what do you think makes a good fiction story?
Oh, wow. Well, I do love secrets. I love secrets in my fiction. I love characters that you just want to hold on to. I just love characters that you get to know intimately, that are spending intimate time together, getting to know one another. I really love coziness and comfort and lots of conversation over warm drinks I just love that aspect of writing and reading. I want to immediately feel immersed, and I don't want to have to put the book down. I want to stay there in that world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have such strong characters in the book and also such realistic dialogue. How do you put that together as a writer?
Thank you. That is a very high compliment. I work really hard at it. I do, you know, when they talk about easy, you know, easy reading is hard writing, but I work really hard. I mean, I keep constant notebooks for my book. I'll write down bits of dialogue. I'll read it aloud a lot. I always listen to my books aloud. I listen to my phone read them back to me over and over again. If anything sounds a little off or weird, you know, I just go back in and revise. But I do love writing dialogue. I like it to be realistic, but also I like it to be a little lifted. I like writing that sounds like writing. I like things that are a little lifted and special, and maybe people having conversations that maybe people don't always have so easily, but I force my characters to have them because that's what makes it exciting.
Mm-hmm. When you're looking at a book, what do you hope readers take away from it?
With this book specifically, I love talking about the magic of everyday moments. I love talking about that in all my books, but especially in this book, the connection that happens so quickly between these two strangers who end up having a really magical, life-changing weekend. Tally's kindness in stopping and caring for another human, even though she's busy and the world gets really loud and noisy and busy, but to notice someone hurting. I think it's really important for us as humans, of course, and not just in today's world, but all the time, but especially for readers who are looking to escape, are looking to feel a bit of softness in this hard world. I do hope that they take away some comfort, some coziness, some light and faith and hope in a dark, dark world from this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's so many writers out there today. What do you think makes you different than many other writers?
You know, I am very proud to be a Black woman who's writing fiction that's not always centered on race. A lot of times Black people are, Black artists, Black writers are put into a category where people are expecting them to only write about race as if we don't have other things going on. And so especially growing up, I always wanted to see books just about Black girls like me, not necessarily dealing with slavery or dealing with civil rights in the Deep South, but just the Black girl who loved unicorns or dragons and things like that. So I decided to write books about Black women and Black people just going about their ordinary lives, not always focused on a race. I feel like that makes me unique. There are writers doing that. I love to be one of them. I'm also a Christian. I'm a believer, and I'm writing books that have Christian characters, but they're also not preachy, and they're also not focused on just one thing. Just really regular people, especially in Kentucky, when a lot of people like to think of stereotypical things when it comes to Kentucky, are only one kind of Kentuckian. But I'm really proud to be a Kentuckian writing about everyday people. So I am proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your books are set in Louisville, which I guess you grew up in Louisville as well as living there now?
Yes, born and raised.
Mm-hmm. So what is it you think that a lot of readers don't understand about this part of the country?
Yeah, they just don't know. I remember talking to someone a while back about another book of mine and then being like, oh, I never really thought about Black people living in Kentucky. Yeah. And it's like, they just don't think about it. They just think of one thing. I don't know, really, you know, even when I travel abroad, you know, it's just like Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's the only thing, you know, that's the only thing they think of when they think of Kentucky. But of course I would excuse them because this is when I was in Paris or this is when I'm in Amsterdam. But here in the United States, it's really wild how many people, they just don't think of people. They only think of horses in the country. They don't think about our cities. They're not thinking about the art, really, or the wide range of people we have living here, the diversity that actually does exist here. And so I think that they just, either they don't think about it at all, or they'll just think about chicken or basketball, which is great. I love those things. But there's a whole lot more, too.
Well, and the characters in this novel are really into fine art. And, you know, you have a lot of references to the Speed Museum in the book. So, I mean, I guess that's another example of things that many people don't really think of often as Kentucky as fine art. Mm-hmm. Well, as a mother of two teenagers, when do you find time to write?
I have much more time now than I did when they were little.
Well, that's true.
So it's really relative. Now I feel like a queen. I feel like I have so much time, even if I just have a couple hours during the day. When they were little, it was a lot harder. I'd have to bribe them with lots of PBS Kids and Goldfish crackers for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This has been Lisa Cross-Smith, who has a new novel out called This Close to Okay. She's a writer in Louisville. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic or an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.